Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
Hi, we're here today with Ken Clark, who I met through a professional business group, and he presented to my group. He runs a therapy company in Arkansas and loved him from the moment I met him. He is a teddy bear of a man and so gifted in the space of the social challenges that we're facing today. And certainly one of them is in the realm of addiction. And how do we support the loved ones of those dealing with people that they love that are dealing with the disease? And so, Ken, I'm going to let you take it from there, and we're going to just have a conversation.
Yay. Well, I'm super honored to be here. I don't think I've had anybody describe me as a teddy bear of a man, but I will take it. That's awesome. So super honored to be here. You know, we're at a really cool juncture in our social discussions about things like addiction, right? We're coming off shows like Mad Men and things like that, where alcohol consumption and you know, wild living are celebrated and all that kind of stuff. That was real four or five decades ago. And 3 decades ago, we began talking about treatment and people with real problems, you know, when it gets really bad. And within the last 20 years, you know, we're having discussions about how do these things get to these places? Mm-hmm. And it's not simply a person who's made a bad decision about how many drinks to have. And even in the last 5 or 10 years, we're now looking at discussions like trauma and how family systems, how the network of people that we're part of heal or hurt us or feed these things or heal them. So it's a really exciting time to be having this discussion. There's a lot of openness and a lot of hunger and a lot of candor around talking about this. And I'm thankful for that, everything that's come before, whether it's 12-step or these great treatment centers. And yet, if you're listening to this, we're part of an evolving discussion that only evolves because we share from our personal experience, talk as both addicts and family members, loved ones of addicts, about the experience. So it's super cool. Yeah. What I think probably my, you know, when I was asked to come on this podcast today, you know, and talk to family members and people supporting, loving on people who are in the recovery process and or not yet, you know, the biggest things that came to mind are always about what it means to support self, to care for self, as opposed to what else do you need to do for this person who to a large degree is beyond your control, you know?
Right.
And so the biggest things that came to mind were grief and shame and dealing with those emotions, right? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes one gives way to the other. And so if you're listening today, I think like we were talking about before the show, we throw around so many of these words, but we don't have a fluency in them. We don't really know what they mean, even though we use them. And so first and foremost, I think that's what I would put out into the space today is probably my definitions of those things. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be your definitions. They don't mean they're definitive definitions. But if you aren't wrestling and looking in the mirror and figuring out what grief and shame means for you, how it impacts your decision-making, your support, your energy levels, that's the low-hanging fruit. So here's my two definitions, right? Grief is the painful process of accepting things that are beyond our control to change. Right. It's the equivalent of swallowing down dry bread, you know, like it's just this, you're just struggling to get this reality down into you and it does not want to go. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's what grief is. If it was changeable, you know, if it was within our control, we don't typically feel grief. We feel hope. Mm-hmm. When we start to come to the realization that this is not going to change and I'm tired of trying or I'm hit my head against a brick wall, that's where grief sets in. And grief is the dark side of the moon. Grief's a lonely place. Grief makes us wonder, what's the point? Why try? Why go on? it can feed our own destructive behaviors. Grief that assigns blame, right? Mm. Grief that says, this grief is your fault. You brought this on yourself. This is your parenting or your failure as a friend or whatever.
Yeah.
That turns into shame. Shame is the belief that I'm reprehensible. I'm bad. I'm worthy of disgust. That mm-hmm. the pain and suffering in my life is so obviously my fault. Anybody looking at it would find disgust with me, right? So shame is disgust turned inward. Shame is disgust turned inward. And so that, if you're listening today and you love somebody who's struggling with addiction, I think those are the two things that I would encourage you to begin taking inventory of yourself, begin labeling and separating. Where am I sad and where am I angry at myself? Mm-hmm. Where is this grief, something that I'm just struggling to accept? Where am I actually placing blame with myself? Because both of those have consequences if we don't label them, deal with them, wrestle right. with them, all that yep. kind of stuff. This is why I'm so thankful for your podcast, because both of those things diminish in the presence of other people struggling with the same things,
mm-hmm.
right? If yes. we're grieving something, we are not understood and we are alone until we run into somebody else grieving the same thing. So you walked in my shoes, all you can show me is sympathy. When you tell me that you've been down this road with your kid, with your spouse, with your best friend, now you understand me. That's empathy. Mm-hmm. And shame has a really hard time existing mm-hmm. in the presence of, oh, I've been that person too, or right. I think that too.
Yeah.
Both of those is we care for them and other people, right? Which mm-hmm. is why these discussions are so important, mm-hmm. why this podcast is so important. When we care for them and other people, we often hear the things we need to hear ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. Right? Yeah. I mean, so when I think about grief, I think about the moment that, you know, I witnessed my son's arrest. I'm standing there on a sidewalk and four cops, you know, lay him on the road. And then there's a fight to get him to the squad car. And he's screaming at me to save him. And so, you know, I was the love in that moment for him. And then I went up to my hotel room and completely lost it, like fell to my knees, cracked wide open. Yes, completely collapsed because everything shattered in that moment. And so allowing myself to be in the grief was the first step. Mm-hmm. And then doing the work with the grief to transform it, transmute it into the service that it has come from it. That's what I think about. And I know so many people. I mean, the day that my son was arrested, one of my CEO's sons overdosed and died. And I walked into that 3 days later. So I'm not alone in this. Mm-hmm. And so as I opened up the conversations with more and more people, I'm hearing more and more stories. And then there's a connecting point in terms of, wow, okay, you understand what it's like to a certain extent and part of the journey, which is very relieving. It becomes, okay, how are you going to navigate this? For me, that was how it was. And then also, you know, kind of moving forward to the shame piece that you're referring to is I've done so many interviews so far, and recovering addicts in particular, one who's a very dear friend of mine was telling her story for the first time in ways that she had never told it before. And in that moment, could still feel the shame from like 30 years ago. And so that's why this conversation is super important.
It's huge, you know, and grief and shame, they are incredibly resilient because they are past tense things, right? Mm-hmm. Even if everything was rosy from the day after your son got released from custody or whatever, and there was never an incident again, mm-hmm. it doesn't erase Mm-mm. the grief of that moment in the same mm-hmm. way that having twins doesn't erase the grief of losing your first child. Like they're mutually exclusive. And I think one that we really encourage people in both caring for themselves and holding space for others is mm-hmm. we need to stop trying to provide grief and shame silver linings.
Mm-hmm.
This weird westernized thing we mm-hmm. do, if somehow you're made whole, then it means you were never damaged. And that's just not how it works. You could be more hopeful and proud of your son than you've ever been. Mm-hmm. And yet the moment that you think about that past tense event, all that grief comes back. Mm-hmm. Grief is this moment that can't be undone, mm-hmm. right? That it's etched in stone. And same with our shame, the things that we remember. Y'all know this, right? You remember those moments from middle school or something where you made the worst joke ever and offended somebody, or that person that we ended a relationship with that we just so wish we had done it different. you're fine until it comes up. And then you get the, like that vomit chill of like, oh, can't believe I did that. Right.
Right.
Well, again, what I would call parallel truths instead of silver linings, there are things mm-hmm. that are simultaneously true. You could be the best person making the best decisions ever mm-hmm. going forward. You could be the best person relationally. You also made a choice that or went through something that will never be fixed. And so I think a big part of that is looking at trauma. You know, this is the big emerging discussion in addiction that I think yes. probably a lot of people who've been around it are like, duh, there's stuff there. But trauma is this thing that makes the ties, the tethers between the past tense shame and grief mm-hmm. and our belief about the future. Like it's mm-hmm. going to continue to be this bad. Trauma and unaddressed trauma, whatever mm-hmm. that is. It doesn't mm-hmm. have to be sexual in nature. It doesn't have to be being in a war zone. You know, just simply being rejected by the people you love growing up is traumatic right. enough. Unaddressed trauma are these toe straps, these chains between the past and the future. And that's a big part of this discussion is as we talk mm-hmm. about grief and shame, it's really tough to make a dent in those without talking about trauma, these mm-hmm. things that forever impacted us, even if we get better from there. Mm-hmm. Think that our brain, our nervous system, our amygdala, right. you know, caught yeah. them off guard and forever rewired the way we see things. So mm-hmm. that's a big part of this too. And I hope if you're listening today that if you're not talking about the things that have left an indelible mark on you, even if it's so much better than what the rest of the world deals with. We hear mm-hmm. that all the time, right? Like
yeah.
stuff so small compared to everybody else. Yeah, but it's your stuff.
Right.
You only had the toe chopped off when everybody else lost their foot. That doesn't mean it didn't hurt to have your toe chopped off, right? Like
right.
It still sucks.
Yeah. We tend to do this comparison thing that minimizes our experience.
You totally do. And I think again, even by definition, if you're listening to a podcast right now, you probably are living a privileged life compared to a lot of people in the world. Like there's a lot mm-hmm. of people that don't have the time or the technology or the mentoring to explore podcasts. So mm-hmm. I bet you if you're on this, you've played that card with yourself of my mm-hmm. stuff's not that bad, therefore I shouldn't feel it. Mm-hmm. That's like hitting the snooze button on grief and shame. Right? Mm-hmm. That alarm's going to go off again in 8 minutes. Get ready.
Yeah. Well, and do you think that a lot of this for some people is just this undercurrent that's running behind the scenes that sometimes they're completely unconscious about?
Shame and grief?
And trauma.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, you know, I can't remember who said it, but, you know, it might've been Mark Twain or C.S. Lewis or somebody said something like busyness is not of the devil. It is the devil, right? Mm-hmm. We as people, and especially again, high performing people do a really good job of distracting ourselves with productivity and meaningful projects and all these things, right? Mm-hmm. As a way of not dealing with those things, as a way of convincing ourselves those things don't define us because look what I'm creating in the face of that. Look what mm-hmm. I've accomplished in the face of that. You know, I'm a doctor now after growing up in a single wide trailer or something. Mm-hmm. Therefore, that childhood is somehow erased. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think it's constantly running in the background because a lot of people are gritty. I mean, if you're dealing with addiction or you're an addict, I mean, give you credit where credit's due. You're tough, right?
Yeah.
And so the ability to put this stuff on hold and distract ourselves with the productive is mm-hmm. where a lot of that gets pushed to the background. Now, mm-hmm. what you and I know, you got some gray hair. I got some gray hair. We're old enough to remember driving in station wagons. Always use the station wagon analogy. I don't know if you remember this when you were a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Mom and dad would pack that back seat to the roof with luggage,
yeah. family yeah. trip.
And somewhere in there, mom or dad would slam on the brakes and all that luggage in the we used to call it the big back. And the big back would come flying over the seat and land on the kids in the middle, right?
Yeah.
That's what happens with our trauma. Like we stay so busy, but all that bag yeah, is just right. sitting unsecured. And the moment life slams on the brakes, the moment that we've got a chance to sit on an airplane and stare out a window, that stuff starts mm-hmm. rushing in. Mm-hmm. Much less we get sick or we have another traumatic event, that luggage comes over the back seat. You know,
right.
It's running in the background for most of us.
Yeah. Well, I tend to think that those accidents or getting sick are kind of the universe's way of saying, whoop, you need yeah. to slow down. This yeah. is something you need to pay attention to. You need to be with this.
It becomes a weird, and I would challenge you if you're listening to this, like think about where this applies in your own life, but it becomes this weird self-reinforcing fallacy of when it finally does come because we've suppressed it for so long, it
right.
comes with such intensity, mm-hmm. reinforces the belief that this is why I keep this stuff
in a bottle.
Yeah. And that's like saying, you know, the reason I don't go to the dentist is because they tell me I have cavities, but then that means you go to the dentist and every time you go, it's a root canal.
Yeah.
Which makes you not want to go to the dentist. Like,
right.
Getting cavity filled, I promise it's better than a root canal.
Yeah.
And yet we treat our trauma like that. We hold off until we're in so much pain that we can't function.
Yeah.
There's
so many people that I've talked to that when I say to them, have you cried? And they're like, not yet. And I'm like, so do you think if you start crying, you're not going to be able to stop? And they're like, and I'm like, trust me, you will stop. You'll wear yourself out and it's all good.
No, if you parented, right? Like your kid will eventually fall asleep on the floor crying, right? One of my favorite moments in therapy, like I live for it. And this is especially true with A-type folks. And in particular, in my experience, A-type, very driven women. There'll be this moment. They come into therapy, you know, they're there for 30 minutes. They're giving me the rundown on the week. You know, it's very who, what, when, where, why, how, organized thought. And then, of course, I come in with my therapeutic moment of like, sounds like that hurt you. You know, and then the chin starts wiggling, the single tear starts coming. And then the line, I always hear, I told myself I wasn't going to do this today.
Right. Yep. And
there's this agreement within self with a lot of A-type gritty people where I'm not going to do emotion. I'm going to keep my stuff together. It comes, it's cathartic. It's 5 to 10 minutes. They let me care for them. And that's funny, right? They pull themselves back together. Okay. I'm good. I'm fine. You know? But that's the routine, right?
Right.
We know that that's there, that crying doesn't make you weak. It doesn't lead to some slippery slope that never ends. It actually makes things better.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in this 5 acts of courage that I wrote, the first thing was feel. And I think that is probably one of the most courageous things people can do is to allow themselves to feel, give themselves permission to feel the feelings.
I think you've heard me say when I've gotten to speak to your groups, being brave without being scared is not brave. It's just dumb. The whole point of courageous is it that you are scared, that it does feel risky. And feeling is that, you know, that because we don't know where it's going to go. We don't know what conclusions our brain will draw. You know, we don't want to consider things because then we might have to make a choice. And so I agree 100%. Like, I mean, it starts with feeling. My wife is a phenomenal therapist. She does a lot of body work and what they call somatic experiencing. And one of the things that even she and I have become aware of as she's done this training is how dissociated.
Right.
All of us are from our feelings, from our body, from our different things, you know, and even beginning to literally physically feel. I'll tell you, as a CEO, there was about 2 or 3 years ago, I was curled up on the floor, fetal position, right? Like one of my friends calls it growing broke. You're growing a business so fast, it feels
right.
And my wife said to me, she said, where do you feel it in your body right now? I was like, go away. Like, I'm a therapist. I know how to do this stuff. But she kept pressing, like, where do you feel it in your body right now? And I stopped and thought about it. I felt burning sensations in my shoulders. So then she asked the crazy follow-up question of, when have you felt that before in your life? What's the earliest you remember feeling that?
Great question.
Yeah. And now I'm going to cry. So I remember being in probably kindergarten and a couple of the neighbor kids holding me down and smashing rotten fruit on me, like neighborhood bullying stuff. But I remember being so embarrassed. And that's where I first remembered. And it was fascinating because in that moment of her asking me to feel, where are you feeling it? And what else is that feeling associated with? Then I realized my fear was not about a business going out of business. I'm an entrepreneur. I've had five or six failed businesses before the business that became an Inc. 5,000 business. What I was afraid of is humiliation.
Right.
When it came to these people that have come to count on me, when it came to my sons having watched me build a business that now made our family successful, I didn't want to go backwards.
Right.
That it wasn't really a cash flow thing, but I didn't know that until somebody asked me to feel, literally, where do I feel it? So there's just a lot of merit there of we as people, we as leaders, we as moms, dads, siblings, people loving on people that are struggling with addiction.
Right.
We need to get in touch with what we feel, literally, physically feel, and what that makes our brain feel. There's so much merit to that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. There's so much to this conversation. Yeah. I mean, I think you and I could just talk for days. And so let me ask you this, just for kind of dialing it in, and I'm interested in your perspective on this. What do you think, I mean, what would you recommend for somebody who is just right in the beginning stages of the crisis of understanding that they their spouse is drinking again, or their child is addicted to fentanyl, or something in that space. What's the first thing that you think is most important for them in terms of self-care?
So again, as a therapist that was trained a decade ago that is now learning from these therapists that are trained with a lot more new recent knowledge, the biggest thing that I'm working with people now is understanding how nervous systems feed off each other. That an addict, whether it's a craving that is ricocheting through their nervous system, right? Mm-hmm. All of who we are, our hopes, dreams, feelings, all that stuff that exists in our nervous system, our depression, our anxiety, our PTSD, these are all nervous system issues. My love for my wife is a nervous system issue, right? That the cravings or the trauma that the cravings are covering up, these are all nervous system things. So something is going on in their nervous system that is driving this. But then that sends my nervous system into fight, flight, or freeze. Mm-hmm. That tells my nervous system, here we go again, or this is because you weren't a good enough dad or whatever. And the sooner that we see ourselves as these interlocked nervous systems that feed off each other, the sooner we can begin having discussions about how, even though I'm feeling this right now, even though they're doing this or I'm responding this way, these are things that are not about me necessarily, even though I'm triggered by it, right? And so really the concept there of differentiation, mm-hmm. that when somebody mm-hmm. starts the slide again, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The opposite of differentiation is fusion, that I'm able to see this as their journey that I'm part of instead of our journey that I'm failing to contribute to or control, right?
Oh, wow. Can you just say that again? Because that is such a critical distinction.
Yeah, that this is their journey that I'm part of, right? That's mm-hmm. that's differentiation. We're in the same chapter, but we're not on the same page, right? Mm-hmm. This is mm-hmm. their journey that I'm part of instead of our journey that I'm responsible for.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
Wow. Exclamation point, people.
And I'm tearing up. My wife had this discussion with me this morning. It was about a business leader. Like, she's like, you've got to stop trying to do everything for everybody that works for us. You've got like, let people be mm-hmm. disappointed. Like, it's not mm-hmm. your responsibility, right? So we all struggle with this. Probably the people that care the most struggle the most. Mm-hmm. But that's what we need to hear is other people's struggles and disappointment, all those things, though we may have some variable that we've contributed. It's also their different journey that we have a shotgun seat to, but it doesn't mean we're the driver. It doesn't mean that we need to mm-hmm. grab the wheel or that grabbing the wheel will make the difference. It might actually cause the crash, right? So working on that differentiation, suffering with somebody without assigning blame to yourself for their suffering. That's that differentiation. That's where we start. Because if you don't accept or find that differentiation, mm-hmm. you act very differently. Like it's yours to fix or it's yours yep. to be blamed for or whatever.
Right. Control.
I grew up in Southern California. Part of what you do there is you go to like lifeguard camp when you're a kid, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the first things they teach you in lifeguard camp, this is if you've been around recovery at all, you're going to be familiar with a similar discussion. A lifeguard can't save somebody who is grabbing on to them for dear life or vice mm-hmm. versa. Like you've got to be able to keep somebody at arm's length to be able to drag them into shore. And that's kind of that differentiation. Mm-hmm. Prentice Hemphill is a phenomenal thinker. One of the things that they said is some version of boundaries are the distance at which I can love both you and me.
Right. That's so, brilliant.
Yeah. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
But that's that differentiation thing. Like uh-huh. if you're holding on to me too tight or I'm holding on to you, we're going to drown. I need to have enough difference mm-hmm. that I can pull you without you clinging to me or vice versa. And that, so that's a lot of the work in these early stages.
Yeah.
It's just getting people to recognize this is somebody else's journey I'm part of.
That's a huge distinction. I don't remember exactly the moment I got clear on that, but what I can tell you is that distinction changed the trajectory of my experience.
Yes. And it induces grief, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. and by the way, that's probably where we stop doing as much shame. Because mm-hmm. if it's our journey that I'm somehow responsible for, then mm-hmm. I'm also responsible for their suffering. Mm-hmm. And that might be something that generates shame. When it's somebody else's journey that I'm part of and don't have control over, mm-hmm. that's something I grieve, because that's what grief is accepting realities mm-hmm. that you don't have the power to change. And when we do that, right, grieving ends in acceptance, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the five stages, all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. the classical model, that's where it mm-hmm. ends up is mm-hmm. this hurts, I'm suffering, but it is what it is. Within right. that context, we can then help better.
Yeah. I talk a lot about loving deeply, and embedded in giving ourselves permission to love deeply, there's going to be pain and grief and suffering. to a certain extent. And so I would much rather love my son as deeply as I love him and go through this journey of his addiction with him. Mm-hmm. But I understand it's his journey. And correspondingly, I have my own journey in this. Mm-hmm. And so I leaned in really hard in my journey in this, which gave me the opportunity to kind of exercise some of my demons and do some deep spiritual work. So that were, those were some of the gifts that were embedded in his journey. So yeah, it's, this is all really full and rich.
Love is one of those funny things. You know, I'm a big, if you ever see me for therapy or coach or work with a company, you'll hear me pushing people to operationalize words. We throw around a lot of words, right? Mm-hmm. Different people, mm-hmm. or we don't even know what they mean. And love is one of those, as a high conflict couples therapist, if I had a dollar for every time I heard people argue about whether or not you love me, I'd be a rich guy, right? And so I'll usually ask them, I'll stop them and say, okay, what is your definition of love? You know, mm-hmm. and it's amazing. They've been arguing about this for 50 years or something as a couple. And they just stare at me like, I offer up, it doesn't mean it's definitive, but my working definition of love is the wonderfully shitty realization that my world does not work without you in it. That's where a lot of us exist, is this space of you bring pain into my world, which on paper means I should reject having you in my world, but I've come to the realization that I can't. That's where differentiation becomes really, really important, because if we're not careful, love turns into possession, obsession, or parenting, or, you know, or like parental real quick.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be shitty. It's going to be hard because somebody else has free agency in that. I always do joke too, by the way, people will tell me that, you know, they fell in love, and I'll always say, well, that was a horrible decision. You know, I mean, love is, gosh, there's just so much pain attached to loving deeply, as you call it.
Yes. Yes.
And yet I don't know that the human existence, when you get to the end of it, if you haven't done that, you don't feel the most regret.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I instances where I've told my story, I have been knocked down so many times. I can't even count at this point because I love so deeply. And I just, in my own way of thinking, thought, okay, I just need to get better and learn how to love smartly. And I'm going to continue to love deeply. And instead of turning off the heart,
yeah,
I was determined never to turn that heart off. Mm. I was still going to lean in and figure this thing out. And so I think that's part of this work when you love somebody who is dealing with the disease of addiction or alcoholism is, and I've read a bunch of Facebook page posts and all the things, is, man, learning to love deeply with, as you said, that separation, that distance is a skill set to learn, is a rewiring of our brains to perfect. And it's not easy. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes intentionality. It takes focus. It takes consistent changing our behaviors. And I think that's one of the things that is extraordinary and has been for me where hope resides is the fact that we can change our behaviors.
Yes.
We can rewire our brains. We can get different outcomes than what we've gotten for 40 years. Mm-hmm. And we know so much more now. And, and what you're speaking to is, again, it's that it gives me hope in terms of better understanding ourselves and the operating system that is our brain. And our life trajectory is not a fait accompli.
Yeah. I'm glad you said rewire our brains. You know, I think it was raised by bootstrappy people who were raised by bootstrappy kids of the depression, all that kind of stuff. We so often, I mean, and you see this within addiction and even, the, you know, this insistence on cold turkey, I'll get through it. You know, I don't need to actually talk about my issues. I just need to put down the bottle or whatever. Not that that doesn't work, but we do a disservice to the incredible machinery that is the human brain and how automatic so much of our stuff is, and that it really does take a rewiring more than it takes a gritty decision. Maybe the gritty decision is to embark on the process of rewiring, but most people trying to restrain addiction or their response to addiction in somebody's life, it's like putting your hand over the mouth when you have food poisoning, like the puke's just going to come out between your fingers. Like good luck with that as a solution.
Right.
We've got to undo the poisoning in us. And that's nervous system brain stuff. You know, I often talk about, you see these videos of like dad or mom reflexes where they, you know, they're doing one thing and the kid falls off the counter and instinctively, like, they catch the kid right before they hit the ground. There was no decision in there.
No.
It was just this instantaneous mm-hmm. survival reaction. Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful part of who we are as creatures. Mm-hmm. That takes some serious work mm-hmm. to reprogram, mm-hmm. where instead of catching a kid off the counter, which you should do, you're mm-hmm. trying to catch a 38-year-old adult or something
right.
as they're imploding their life, deciding to leave their spouse and drinking too much. Like it, mm-hmm. it's a different animal, even though the brain treats those as the same thing. Mm-hmm. That takes work. That mm-hmm. takes practice. That takes an mm-hmm. outside set of eyes, accountability, grace, all those things.
Hell so yeah.
You're listening to this and your solution is to be tougher. Be tougher by deciding to get consistent help with this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is a team sport. My community, I mean, I was on the bat phone like yeah. right away after I got home after that particular instance. And fortunately, you know, I have a fantastic community. And I continue to expand my community. And what we know is that community is one of those number one, most powerful things that we need to have in place in order to navigate life at a successful, thriving level.
It's one of the highest predictors of relapse coming back from a rehab stint mm-hmm. is whether or not somebody's into community. And it's also, and I'm thankful for inpatient and what it provides to people. But the reality is when you're coming back to an unhealthy network, which is where the existence
yes.
is. Mm-hmm. Foster and all that. Like, mm-hmm. that's why it's so dang hard. I don't mean to make light of it, but gosh, it's a lot easier to go be healthy in an environment where everybody is pulling for your sobriety, where you're getting three squares mm-hmm. a day. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe somebody's making you sit in a sauna to get the toxins out of your body. Mm-hmm. Like in that environment, it's easy to make a resolution, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you come back to the very system
right?
that makes you unhealthy, mm-hmm. right? Or people mm-hmm. come back to a system that contributes to the health. That's where relapse occurs or doesn't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we would do better, if we really look at addiction treatment better, mm-hmm. we would begin treating people more in the environment in which the addiction exists,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to sending them off into a situation that's unrealistic. Not that that doesn't save lives or teach skills, mm-hmm. but driving in a simulator is very different than driving on the road. And we mm-hmm. would not let somebody learn how to drive in a simulator and cut them loose.
Right.
Right. I've actually driven a semi, but here you go. Good luck. You did
yeah. great. Yeah. So yeah. Well, which is another reason why Voices Encouraged was born, was because I could not find the resources to be healthy and thriving when Sam popped out the other side. And so, yes, that's what this is all really, you know, to some extent all about. And the truth of the matter is, for me, addiction, alcoholism, all the things are just the big red flags of humanity.
Yeah.
We have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
To strip away all the stuff we've been buried with, to get back to who we really, 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 truly are. And as extraordinary human beings walking this planet. So,
and we cannot do that in isolation. That community and connection and conversation mm-hmm. and wandering moments where I don't know if we're just having coffee today or if stuff's going to get real and we're going to get deep, but, mm-hmm. but those space for spontaneous connection, self disclosure, that's crucial to this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. That's why these mm-hmm. conversations, whoever's listening today, like, may sound like a conversation between two of us, but it's a conversation between all of us.
Yes.
And that's where we slowly chisel away differentiation. We talked about that earlier. Differentiation mm-hmm. takes the ability, it requires the ability to compare slightly different things and say, oh, this versus this, right?
Mm-hmm,
where a little kid says, I like pizza like mom and dad, but I don't like pepperoni like dad. I like sausage like mom. That's mm-hmm. differentiation. We mm-hmm. get that process of comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Till I hear you talk about your journey and I'm able to go, oh, wow, that's like me, except not like me in this
right.
way. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's where differentiation occurs. Mm-hmm. You mm-hmm. cannot do that without data from other people.
Right.
Right. Without other things to compare ourselves against. So the biggest gift all of you and that you give hosting this podcast
mm-hmm.
is just getting to hear one more version of the same story. So you can decide how your story is same or different.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Because there are going to be things that we've talked about today that people can, I'll take that piece.
Yeah.
I'll take that piece. I'll take that piece. The rest of it, I'm leaving. And that is what it's all about. Mm. Take the pieces that serve you in elevating into, you know, healthy, whole, thriving, and let the rest go. I don't have any attachment to what you pick, but yeah. I do have a conviction about being the best version of yourself.
Yes. Yes. And it's a fine tuning. The guy that I learned differentiation from, there's a guy named David Elkind. He's an author. He talks about adolescent development is where I got this years ago when I was doing youth work. But he talks about the unhealthy opposite of differentiation. That process of differentiation is the thing he calls substitution, which is where I decide my life is not working. So I'm just going to try and be you because your life is working.
And
yet how you got to be you was probably this process of tweaking, you know, these different things. So don't substitute. Don't ever become one of us. Like you just heard, pick what works, keep it, discard the rest.
Absolutely.
I'll one other thing. It's a line that slipped out in a couple of my recent speaking gigs, and people keep writing it down like I've been saying it my whole life or knew what I was saying, but it's resonating. So I'll throw it out there in the space for you to consider and maybe use for a future show, which is our normal may be other people's trauma. Our normal may be other people's trauma. And so even as we talk about this right now, what's normal for the two of us and how we handle that, if this is triggering for you right now, that's what happens, right? If you're anything in this, your soul rebels against it. That's okay. Our normal is other people's trauma. What's normal for some of your listeners is my trauma. And so that's where differentiation again is really important, because if you're trying to be what you see, not somebody else, you may be forcing yourself right back into the trauma box that you're trying to escape from. That's a tall order.
Well, I know you're up against time constraints here, Ken. So let's end with that, which obviously was brilliant. And I want to just say thank you. How grateful I am for you, you know, our paths having crossed and for you being in my life. And this is, you know, one step on that journey and path that we're on together that I am very, very grateful for. So
it's one of those serendipitous meant to be things. I my world is a better place because you are in it, and I'm thankful for it. And the fun part is it's just getting started.
Absolutely.
I'm grateful for you, and you're so fun.
Thank you.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.